This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize. Hello for folks joining us. Happy Friday. Welcome to this week's TGIF. We'll just have a nice, informal, fun chat in a couple of minutes, just catching up on all things DIA. Get a readout on what we saw and what some of the takeaways were and what the vibe was, and hopefully have a few minutes to hear from all of you as well. If you were there, if you were not, we'll just keep it informal today. Sound good by you, Jane Miles?
Yeah, it sounds perfect.
Mm-hmm. All right. And good morning to you, Joe Dustin.
Craig, how you doing? Jane, how are you?
Great.
I was DIA. You were DIA. All you guys. That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Good opportunity to just regroup. What do you think, Jane? Should we just jump right in?
I say let's go.
All right. Hello and welcome. For those of you joining us here live, welcome to this week's TGIF DTRA. And for those of you joining us through our replay or through the podcast, welcome to you as well. We do gather here most Fridays, sometimes occasional Fridays in the summer, but most Fridays, 12 to 1 Eastern, using Zoom, connected through LinkedIn, blah, blah, blah. But if you are able to find those links and join us here live, that's fabulous. You get to jump in on the conversation, share your thoughts, perspectives, questions on the topic of the day. If this time of day doesn't work for you, maybe you're in Europe and off enjoying dinner or an early cocktail with the family, totally understood. That's why we have our streams available. Those streams are available through your favorite podcast platform. If you haven't checked them out, you can search for Decentralized DTRA on Spotify or wherever else you listen. There are not only a couple of dozen, there are a couple of hundred episodes of content there. So be sure to scroll through. Maybe there's a topic there that's really important to you or just a curiosity to you. These topics come from you, the folks and friends in our community. And so if there's a topic you'd love to see us cover in the weeks and months ahead, feel free, reach out. You can always drop a note through LinkedIn to myself or Jane. You can always send an email to secretariat@dtra.org. We'd love to hear from you. And maybe you've got a publication coming out. Maybe you've written a paper. Maybe you've got some data. Maybe you've got a recent pilot or some experience that you'd love to share. Maybe you're doing a talk at a conference on a topic. If you have something that's on your schedule in terms of data, evidence, perspective, let us know, and we'd love to have you come on and share some deeper dive. It's sort of a great way for the audience to get to dig in with you as an author or presenter and ask their questions. Okay, that's my little opening prequel. Jane, what did I miss?
You missed nothing, and we do have a new publication we're going to publicize here in a couple of weeks. So, breaking, the BYOT white paper is complete. It's legal review. Hurrah! So we'll be ready to come and talk. Joe is here. He's been a co-lead with the project. So we will invite the leaders to come and share what it was like to work on it, some of their key findings, where they're headed next, and make the call to action to join the current effort.
Fabulous. That sounds like a great example of you've got some content, you've got some work you've been building, find some other ways to share it, get it out there, and make it interactive by using platforms like what we have here. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation, especially interested because I love this theme of sites being able to leverage more of their own technology stack in the context of clinical trials in general, decentralized in particular. It just lends itself well when we're looking at what the real barriers are when it comes to adoption and implementation. So thrilled to have that one coming up in the queue, Jane and Joe. So we are streaming here live on June 27, and we've chosen this as a date to do a little bit of a recap for the DIA annual meeting that just took place last week. It was last week, right? I feel like I've
It feels
run
longer,
around.
honestly.
Feel like we've been running around ever since, doesn't it?
And some of the people in the audience were there too, so we're really curious and excited to hear your perceptions of what happened, what you saw, what got you curious too.
For those of you that aren't familiar, DIA, formerly known as the Drug Information Association, but much like Kentucky Fried Chicken and other brands like Dunkin' Donuts, sometimes that brand sort of streamlines their name. And so DIA, I believe, is just DIA. But that is a community of drug developers and regulators. It's a community of individuals who join as members of this professional organization, whether you're in a site, a CRO, a tech or service provider, whatever your background, it's a very broad and diverse community. DIA's annual meeting gathers a few thousand folks at various convention centers each June. This year was in Washington, D.C. They made clear to make sure we know that next year it's in Philadelphia. That was pretty strong and clear message of book a room, come to Philly next year. DC, though, is always a great venue for the DIA because with the regulators down the street, they usually get a very strong representation from FDA and other government agencies. But the DIA is a great convening place, not just for the FDA. I think one of the reasons the FDA shows up is because the PMDA, the EMA, the SFDA, the regulators from around the world use that for convening and for information sharing. But it was certainly a great opportunity there at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center. It'll be interesting to chat at Jane a bit about just overall sentiment about sessions that kind of popped, whether keynote or subsequent sessions, about the format in general and what may have been new going on, and sense in the exhibit hall. And of course, if there's other takeaways that folks may have from their time down there or up there, depending on where you call home.
Well, let's start with the plenary. And by the way, there was a big call to action to go to Philly right in the plenary session.
What
It's
was
always
that call to action? Yeah.
go to Philly, and Ben Franklin will help you get there.
Yes, a little bit of an opening shout out video to Ben Franklin, summoning you to the city of brotherly love for next June. The opening plenary, I think opened really strong with Jimmy, who I had the pleasure of hearing some of his story back in January at a White House OSTP meeting on cell and gene therapy. And he really, is so poignant in sharing his journey related to sickle cell and telling the story of himself versus another peer who might have been born in the same African country around the same time as him. But his journey of being able to travel to the United States with his family and what that has meant for his outcomes today as a person who was able to receive a gene therapy versus kind of a peer somebody who might have been a classmate back in Africa, who passed away a few years ago from the same condition. And so certainly an opportunity to celebrate remarkable breakthrough therapies like cell and gene therapies and the incredible outcomes that they bring, life-changing, but also a poignant recognition of the disparities in care, not just that we see here in the US where I happen to live, but when we look on a global basis. I thought Jimmy's final call out was really interesting to me around the almost psychosocial needs of patients who are receiving remarkable life-changing interventions like a gene therapy, because of just how much of a change in his life that drug has created for him, from being somebody who, as a child, spent seemingly as many days in the hospital as he spent outside of the hospital, with a host of restrictions on things that he could and couldn't do, to the world that in life he's able to live today.
Yeah, I've appreciated that the DIA has added more patient voice into the content of the meeting as a whole, and they really try hard to include it from the plenary stage, which I think is always good to remind us of the why. I love Jimmy's talk, but I gotta say, the nerd in me has a new crush on Dr. Doug from Vertex. I think I have his name correct. Who has spent his life actually working on, of all things, frog developmental biology, but because of his family, got really interested in type 1 diabetes and wondered how could I make an infinite supply of islet cells available to patients with type 1 diabetes. What I loved about his story, Craig, was he was just so darn humble, right? He's clearly deeply skilled in things I'll never understand. And he also thought that he would get these answers much faster than he's been able to. But he is one of those people who is so well versed in his own topic, he makes it simple for the rest of us to understand. That was a game changer for me. He was great at explaining how you can go through these different developmental stages in cell differentiation and how you could influence how the cells would change. It just got me excited. So that was the nerd in me.
Well, I mean, it is a great reminder. He was a great reminder of how brilliant one must be to be able to reduce things so complex to make them so remarkably accessible. And the work he's doing in cell therapy for type 1 diabetes, the kind of game-changing outcomes that he's creating, and now shifting from academia at Harvard to industry at Vertex to bring that same capability to extraordinary scale is just awesome to see. So that was great. That was also a great opening.
I might have to see if I can audit his developmental biology class because I think he teaches still at Harvard. And I'm like, I could learn some things here. And then there was an interesting conversation where Dr. McCary talked about the direction of the FDA. And a lot of the messages had been shared in other fora, I should say. But people were really engaged and very attentive. That was my observation. And then there was a good discussion about, well, what do you think is going to happen with all the plenary speakers, and a couple of extras, right?
Yeah, some folks from EMA, from MHRA leaders there that were at DIA and participating in different subsequent sessions, also just sharing, perspective, whether it's around the latest in technology or policy considerations. And it was interesting to have that kind of balanced with Sudip Parikh, also on the panel. Sudip was the past executive director. Or leader for DIA. He now leads the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and is the publisher of the journal Science. So he's kind of up there as the person whose job it is to advocate for science, which, interestingly, when he left DIA for that job, I thought to myself, why does science need an advocate? And It seems like here we are in 2025, and that's a pretty darn important job now more than ever. So it was pretty cool to have him back in the DIA room in this new role in the year 2025.
Yeah, I think he was also courageous. He just put his beliefs right on stage, and I appreciated that. Like, we really have to invest in science as a framework for innovation and progress across society. Those weren't his words. I'm paraphrasing, but
It was pretty darn close. Something to the effect of, we don't have, whether it was 18 or $48 billion of waste, fraud, and abuse in the NIH to lose right now. And so he was very blunt on that, and that's his job right now. And I think for those in the research community, can there always be efficiency in the process? Absolutely. Do we think it's that order of magnitude that we can lose in terms of funding of medical research for those working in this area? I think the signal is a pretty strong. It's the degree of waste, fraud, and abuse does not equate to that level of cuts today.
So then we got into content, and those of you who know me know I am a self-professed content nerd. So I usually triple book sessions, and I wasn't disappointed. Like, in fact, I was inspired. I was really impressed generally with the preparation and the content that was delivered from the sessions. And most of the ones that I attended were actually very well attended. There were a couple that were at tough time slots because my brain got full, right? But I was certainly very delighted with the content. And I'll give a shout out to Joe, who's part of the program committee, because I know that's actually how I got to know Craig, how hard that job is, like finding the topics that are going to resonate and then pairing up the different sessions that are really interesting and might actually have a nice Venn diagram common theme, because there aren't as many slots as there are great topics.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
Craig, what was a takeaway for you from the content side of the house?
It was interesting to me in that I feel like, some people noticed, and it's and it is a fact that the turnout is down for the DIA annual meeting. Certainly when we look at kind of the heyday of a few years ago, where we'd get 7,000 to 8,000 people at the convention center, landing closer to 3,500 is a noticeable difference. It felt like the sessions were still very well attended, that the folks that were there to capture the content, and the rooms were busy. This isn't a slight on events like Scope. I love the Scope Summit, but sometimes I feel like the sessions are very lightly attended. There are some that get a big room. There are a lot that are pretty light in terms of turnout. People are stuffed in the exhibit hall. It felt like at DIA, the exhibit hall was kind of light and chill. The sessions, on the other hand, still had a lot of participation, a lot of questions.
So this is not a fact. It's a Jane cynical possibility. I can remember attending DIA when I was on the sponsor side, and it was almost like when I went to the exhibit floor, there was too much to consume, and it was a little bit like running the gamut, right? So it made me wonder, with fewer people in the exhibit hall, if some of the sponsors were thinking that being one of the sponsors there might make them an even more desirable target. Maybe not.
We've been there where you feel like you have a target on your back. You walk by with your name badge, and people are saying, "Oh, hey, Jane, how was your session?" And you're like, "Do I even know you? That's amazing how quickly you read my badge. I th thought I had turned it backwards for that reason."
It's not a bad thing. It just I kind of hope that isn't the case, but I also noticed that the exhibit hall was not as full of consumers. There were still quite a number of exhibitors. Maybe others saw it differently.
I think one of the exceptions to me was the Innovation Theaters, and these were some rooms that, well, not rooms, there were spaces in the exhibit hall on the corners, on the edges, that were set up for some talks. Some of them were more sponsored talks, and some were, things like the whale tank, which we can talk about. But it did seem like when those were taking place, there was a lot more life coming into the hall. So, some of it I think is also an artifact of the floor plan of the Washington Convention Center, which obviously the DIA can't control. But when you're in like the Boston Convention Center or even Philly, the exhibit hall feels like it's right in the center of the action. And the rooms are just in the periphery around it. Whereas in DC, the journey from the session rooms to the exhibit hall is multiple levels and multiple turns and multiple hallways. So it just made it feel separate. The Innovation Theaters seem to bring some of the session energy back in.
Yeah, I'm going to double click on your Innovation Theater observation because I agree. I went to several of those sessions and several of them were standing room only. I got to give some love to Lauren Toby, who's one of our most active leaders from Lilly in DTRA solution generation. And she and her colleague led a great session on digital health technology and some work they've been doing to clarify how to actually embed that into your program development. I talked to Lauren this week for a few minutes, and she said that she was really pleased with how it went. And she's had several members of the FDA reach out to her since the Innovation Theater session to say, hey, can we talk more about the template that you and your team developed at Bio? So she definitely thought it was successful. Everyone in that room seemed pretty excited and engaged with the topic. So, Innovation Theaters, lots of great content there. And it's a reasonably new offering from DIA, maybe in the past 5 years.
Yeah, just in the last few, I think. I think it's also in part a reaction that the DIA clearly skews towards neutral content, which is their differentiator, but also makes it a little more challenging. Right. Again, this isn't a slight to Scope or DFARM or whatever other conference you like. Those are also great, but they're also curated. And they're also heavily recognizing the organizations that are sponsors of the event to make sure that they're being represented on stage. The DIA does not recognize exhibitors with sessions. It is all neutral in that regard. But there are exhibitors and folks that are sponsoring that do have stories to tell and updates to share. And the Innovation Theater does create that space. It's a little separate space, and that's okay. The whale tank was probably the other big difference that made its maiden appearance breaching into the exhibit hall to let itself be known. Joe Dustin, did you want to jump in on that perspective on session content in the Innovation Theaters?
DIA has been around for 61 years now, I think it is. And I think you nailed it, Craig, that they are the event that spans the full gamut of drug development. You can go there and learn pretty much everything if you want. It's not just a clin-op show, it's not just a regulatory show, although regulatory is definitely has been the it's always been a theme, like there's a central focus of regulatory in everything somewhere. Just given that's their history. What I like about DIA is that it is like the only one left that's kind of the neutral convener of our industry that's non-biased, non-commercial. You can be anyone and submit an abstract. There's no pay to play for like sessions. You can't pay $50,000 to get on stage and pitch something. They don't allow it. The regulators show up knowing they're not going to get hounded by drug companies that where they had a application may be delayed or whatnot. I also think that you're right, you nailed it before. While the exhibit hall, I think, was a noticeable, very noticeable decline, the sessions were very busy and the content was hot. And I'm on the program committee and it was quite fun, my first time being on that, like selecting the abstracts. And it was a mix of like, like lobbying around Congress, trying to like shop abstracts around the ones that maybe I don't know, doesn't fit here. Guy got to bring it over here and like pitch it and stuff. It was kind of cool. I think DIA still has a place. What I've noticed about this compared to other events is that obviously DIA is very broad. Other events like Scope or others are very specialized, and there's just more places to go now, right? But if you're new to drug development, I don't think the future of our industry is going to learn this stuff from an AI bot. I think they're going to go to DIA and learn. Like that's where people should be going. It's like your professional association you should be a member of, right? That's kind of the point. The other thing I learned about DIA, which I've been going for 20 years, but I've only been more involved, not just as an exhibitor from the past, but as a someone on the organizing committee and the advisory board, and even when I was in pharma, they're in a, maybe not everybody knows this. At least if you're on the exhibit hall, you certainly don't know this. They're an accredited like educational organization, which means that people go to DIA to go to sessions, knock out all these like continuing education credits to keep the letters after their name in check. Sometimes they don't go to the hall to meet anybody, but they can bang that out in one meeting. And that means they can't do certain things. You can't have paid sessions, even close to the track sessions. Everybody has to be in the exhibit hall away from everything. And there's so many things that DIA can't do, which I think from a commercial perspective and from people that want to sponsor DIA is becoming less attractive. And they're trying to find new ways to make that better. Because there are its strengths it draws on. So I think a lot of, if you're on the vendor side, you may have deprioritized DIA this year. But if you're on the pharma side, you still have a value here because you're not thinking about the exhibit hall, you're thinking about the content and finding out what we need to do and hearing from the regulators and understanding, where our industry is sort of going. It's definitely one of the events that should be in your list, especially if you're new to the industry.
I think the challenge is people want specialized events in their domains. We don't really have generalists, and pharma doesn't really employ a lot of entry-level people. Those entry-level people are now employed at the CROs, and the CROs aren't sending and have the resources right now to send entry-level people out for a lot of learning. And so we have this gap. Right, the pharma people want specialized events, which is why the DIA does very well with people with regulatory in their titles. It draws them out because the regulators are there. The regulatory town hall, the FDA town hall, the very last session on the very last day, which should be an empty room full of crickets, is the packed, like sold out room, right? For the Thursday morning of an event that started that Sunday evening. And so people on the regulatory side get it. I think the DIA has to sort of figure out its why for others to feel like they have a reason to go if they are a leader in ClinOps, if they are a leader in data management, because right now those folks are going to ACRP or they're going to SCDM, but they're not necessarily feeling that the DIA has the depth and sophistication of content that they need. If there are a couple of interesting 1 hour sessions, that's just not going to be enough to make the case to their boss to go for 2 or 3 days when they could go for 2 or 3 days of like 2 or 3 days of content on data management.
Well, so that's why I became a DIA junkie, though, Craig, because I told you, self-professed content nerd, always triple booked my sessions, and actually exercised my right to choose. So if I wasn't learning or getting something out of the session, it was like tee up the next one on the list in a way that wasn't meant to be disrespectful, but so you maximize the learning opportunity of the meeting. What I noticed this year, even in my own panel, was that a lot of the people, even the speakers, are now only approved to attend for a single day by their management. And those folks could be from sponsors or CROs. And so that also makes the numbers hard to quantify, like who was there and how long were they there. And did you see them? They may have been there and fully engaged, but it was a one-day turnaround. Anyhow,
Yeah, I
also,
agree. I feel like as a result, 3,500 people total might have felt more like 2,500 at any one day because of a lot of transient folks that only had that approval for a day or so.
I would say I was in the FDA town hall too. I think we were both in seats and there were none left. So a lot of people who are not formally in regulatory but are deeply impacted by regulatory policy and decision making were in that room, which is actually what makes it fun,
Yeah, it's the
right?
room where it happened, right? You want to hear it from the voices. And I have to say, the MHRA town hall I sat in, packed room. I didn't get to the EMA town hall, but I think all of these like very thematic ones with leadership there are certainly huge draws for the event. And obviously a cornerstone they have to keep. But then how do you pick up the same for the data management crowd, for the ClinOps crowd, so that they also feel that there is this must attend sentiment because that's where the leaders are going to be sitting up front and sharing important updates.
What's interesting is that also notable for DIA, and I know I was involved a little bit in this one, but it was a group effort to offer free passes very much to people, especially being in Washington, and with the number of federal employees that have been dogged, I guess is the word, that are looking for jobs. And DIA has always been a bit of a job fair, as well as a networking opportunity and an educational moment. And so I thought it was really nice and really good of DIA to kind of re recognize that moment that there's a lot of people locally where they were. And I think that I'm not sure how many people they got, but I know it was at least over 500 people that registered from that community,
That's
at least a
fabulous.
day
I
or
think that
two.
was a really important step. And, look, you could say, well, look, if I'm an exhibitor, those folks aren't buying anything from me, but too bad, there, but for the grace of God, go I. That could be you, being impacted today. And I think it was a tremendous step for DIA to take. It's not trivial to open your doors to that many additional impacted folks. But they're just such an important part of how we get things done in our ecosystem. And I agree. Hat tip to DIA for making those doors open.
It was a tell too, because if you've been at DIA, you know that one of the fun things that they offer in the DIA booth is you get to choose your own ribbons for your badge. And this year, one of the most colorful and noticeable ribbons was Open to Work. And I saw people from every part of the ecosystem with that ribbon on, which was great because it made it very easy. And not at all awkward to say, so how could we help you? What are you looking for? What do you want to do next? So I thought that was great. Yeah, I had Slay the Day as well and a Troublemaker. So yeah. I also think this is just, nerdy me. I think that DIA has an opportunity to maybe high grade, we'll say. Original data sharing, not to replace a scientific meeting like ASCO. It doesn't have to be therapeutic area data, but if we have operational data, if we have metrics on trends around study, anything, I think people crave it. And I was in a few sessions. I got to lead one myself. Those were really well attended, and people were like super camera happy because they want to take that data back to their organizations.
That's a
So
great call
it's
out, Jane, to think about, ways to both flag that on the program that this has OGD, come check out some original data here and make sure that that's kind of being celebrated or featured for folks who are either considering an abstract for submission or who are reviewing the program to for spots to attend. Maybe they need to reserve some more late breakers because I think one of the challenges folks have is we're submitting our abstracts by what, September of this
yeah.
year, and we're talking about who's going to have data available to show for June of the following year. So you either have an incredibly disciplined pipeline of the research that you're planning to execute, or can the DIA hold some more, like ASCO does, right? Like you mentioned, late breaker sessions. Now, in their case, as you say, it's here's that phase three trial that everybody's been waiting for that new molecule. In our case, it's a little more process data, but it's still really important to be able to feature and make room for.
Well, hey, let's talk about the FDA snapshot report and the trends you're on. There is a myriad of topics where we could talk about data.
Jane, what kind of data did you share at the DIA annual meeting?
Gee, funny you should ask. By the way, that was one of those we were disciplined and we had some luck. So in September, we proposed the idea of collecting data on HCP perceptions about being involved in clinical research as non-investigators. And we got some curiosity and interest from our member organizations. And we're going to have a whole session on this topic later in July. But we partnered with a market research organization that does a lot of work in pharma, and we're able to collect original data from healthcare practitioners in a specific therapeutic area around. Did they know that they have a place? What do they think about it? What would be a barrier? What would be a driver? And it was really fun because we also polled the audience about what they thought the HCPs would feel. So that's a very quick summary. What was equally cool, though, was we got to talk with some of the sponsors who are working to make this model a reality. And some of it is still pretty ambiguous. Our fourth panelist was Megan Chalasani, who is from C3TI, the innovation hub within CDER. And I think that some of the things that come up as concerns or risks might even have been a little surprising to Meghna. So I'm hopeful that that's a teaser for you to join us later when we have a deeper conversation on the topic.
Yeah, I think that's a great setup for a subsequent conversation here on TGIF with more of that data. I think it's this topic of HCP sentiment when it comes to supporting routine care is certainly a hot one, right? It's re represented in the DCT final guidance. It's represented in the draft guidance on randomized trials and routine care settings. And so, there's a lot of, I think, enthusiasm and question and excitement and concern among the research community about what does this mean and how can we have more of our study procedures from the protocol happening in these healthcare settings, whether with physicians, PAs, NPs, pharmacists, phlebotomists, or otherwise. Nobody seemed to be asking the HCPs, especially those who are not investigators in research. Those are the ones we want to get engaged, but they're not coming to the DIA and they're not hanging out with us at Scope. And so this has been a really cool journey to generate insights together with the partners at Canovo Research to understand what physicians really think and what are their concerns and where are they excited about this topic. And so I'm really excited to have seen some of the early findings coming out from that at the DIA and now to see how much more content is able to get created and shared and circulated to demystify this, to help us to understand where there are concerns that we should be anticipating so that when companies, especially those like we saw on the dais for your session, like UCB and Lilly that are kind of blazing the trail, what are the concerns that they should anticipate and be ready to mitigate when engaging healthcare providers in this new way?
Ted,
Did
what would you
mind
like
if
to
I
add?
jump in, Jane, or
Sure.
I certainly had FOMO when you all posted Jane when you were there with Shelley, who I knew very well and a friend and certainly a trailblazer in this place. I know Brittany a little bit. I've met Megana and I really don't know Erica on that crew, but it was I think one of the things that we're seeing out there is you need to have the three CTI and the sponsors really leading the charge on some of this routine care and getting the HCP engaged
and asking for their help. And I'm sensing that from a lot of sponsors out there. And so the question I had is, when you were in that session, was there a excitement around moving that forward from the sponsor level? Because I know that some of these early adopter sponsors are in. They're ready. Let's go figure this out. Let's try it. Let's not chase perfect. Let's go and get something that we can work with and find more participants. Were you sensing that from other sponsors that were in the room or at the session at DIA? I guess maybe that's Jane for you.
Yes, and it's a good call out. I will actually go back to DIA and see if they can give me our Slido data. But we asked a question in the session of the audience: how excited is your organization about the possibility of HCPs being involved as non-investigators? It was off the charts, right?
Okay.
Now, there were a few that said not at all interested, but the majority were either interested or very interested. So it was, that doesn't mean that they're ready.
No.
There's a big difference there. So we'll park that. I'll try and get the data. So it's a great question, Ken,
Okay.
Ted. And we
Yeah.
talked a lot about, we had some good questions in the session. Most of them were actually around what I'll call operational contracting and financial friction.
There was a session that you all had with a person, I think was ran oncology at North Carolina. I'm forgetting her name right now. And
Caitlin.
she had made some great strides in that contracting piece that has really opened some eyes on how that. And now I know there's a little bit of gravitas with that organization that helped with that. But I agree, we've got a path around relative value units and practice expense and how that can work with this, but we need to execute on it.
Yeah. So let me think. Craig, what else would you like to call out? The whale tank. We talked about the whale tank for a minute.
Yeah, we didn't really get to dive into what that looked like. This was sort of a first experiment for DIA. The well tank are the folks that run the innovation gathering. I guess that's the hook, the connection. Guys like Jeff Smith, for those that aren't familiar, the Innovation Gathering is another one of the fall Clinical Trial Innovation Conference lineup season. Their event seems a little different. They seem to run an event that has a little more of a TED-like vibe. Not you, Ted. Bart is in here in the room, but
There
the all caps TED vibe. It's still your vibe, Ted. You're pretty cool
you
too.
go.
But a little more of that vibe event, but also with a little more workshoppy kind of problem solving theme to it. And they brought some of that to the DIA with their whale tank, which is kind of a pitch event, 4-minute rapid fire pitches from some entrepreneurs and innovators, a bit of judging. And from what I understood, the real pearl for the folks that were presenting wasn't the frenetic, chaotic 4-minute pitch, but was the treasure of getting to debrief with the folks that were the judges, who were apparently fabulous at sharing some really good, frank, honest, straight talk, which entrepreneurs need to hear, right? They're investing time and money into creating solutions they want to believe are going to be impactful for folks that are at sites and in pharma and in other, stakeholder organizations. And if people can't be honest and straight with them about what they're hearing and whether it's going to land or not, they're not going to be able to produce a solution that's meaningful for you. And so for those that are out there that served as judges, hat tip to you, because your frank, straight talk really seemed to land well with the pitching companies that I've certainly connected with after the whale tank.
There was definitely a lot of energy in that room, right? I didn't see all the pitches. I did go to the session where they announced the winners, and they had a really great panel discussion with some of the judges around, well, what do you need to consider and tell me what's not realistic, basically. Like, I think one of the most probably straight talk questions that got asked and answered was directed to Lauren Sunshine. And the question from an innovative startup company was, why is it that it's so hard for me to get any business from study teams? Like, my thing is ready and you're really interested in it. And she was straight up. She said, what I'm interested in isn't necessarily what the study teams are ready to do. And it is actually quite an effort to get through the qualification process if you're not a qualified vendor, which is a whole different issue to solve in pharma. But I appreciated her straight talk, and Peter Gallagher from GSK added his insights in that session too on the same question. Anyhow, you were
I
there.
was a judge. I was a judge in the whale tank as well. I was involved in trying to set it up. I was the industry navigator judge as opposed to a buyer or an investor. So what I really liked about the whale tank was, first of all, the feedback in the floor was like the place was packed, and the kind of it was different than the innovation theater where you have some already known company trying to put up something usually, but this was sort of like meant for 0 to 1 startups that aren't going to pay $10,000 to get, or however much it costs to get on stage, right? This was much different. But the feedback in the roundtable, I know at least one company got a pilot on the spot during that roundtable from a pharma company to say, we're going to go back and we're going to do this. And to Lauren's point, because I experienced this when I was in pharma as well, when you're trying to be innovative and even do innovative things with new companies, there's a lot of larger pharma companies that are really bad at creating the space to make that happen because no one's going to go through full-on crazy procurement and third-party risk management processes and crazy audits if you don't even know the new thing you want to try is going to work. So we are really bad at this in our industry, and I think that there are ways around this, but the bigger companies struggle with this.
Also, have processes that are exactly for what you're talking about, Joe. And I lived in a company like that where our legal and compliance understood, okay, we need a little space to give it a try before we invest all of the effort and time to go through a full preferred vendor status qualification. But not everyone has that. So it was really great. And I'm super happy to hear that at least one of the participants got a pilot. Hey, Jess, you were at DIA too. I'm calling you out, and you might feel uncomfortable, but I'm curious if you have any insights or observations you'd like to share from DIA 2025. And if you can't, that's okay too. She might be involved in something she can't get off the phone. Okay, well, Joe, then.
I will give the shout out to Jess for calling out the her favorite ribbon, the colors outside the lines. So we'll throw that one in the bin for not in the trash bin, in the bin for most popular and interesting playful ribbons at DIA this year.
So, Joe, what's our timeline to submit for 2026?
So the call for topics, like the key topics for DIA for next year is like I think it's July 11th to, and that's just high level topics. Like if you have some topic that you want to hear about or that DIA should be then asking for abstracts for, that's next month. I believe we don't have an abstract close date, but the abstracts are going to open up in the summertime. They do it so fast. Like it's just it takes so long to review these things. That the abstract closures are in September, already for next June. So, yeah, so that's going to be coming up over the next few months to start to get the abstracts in for next year. So.
But the call for topics is literally just, hey, I want to hear more about subject X, not, and I propose to talk about it with these people and cover this specific.
Correct. Yeah, that's just quickly off the top of your head, or if something's important to you, pop it in. We should share a link to that in your show notes.
Well, and obviously AI was everywhere. Was on
AI
stage, it
was
was in
everywhere.
aviation theaters, it was in the exhibit hall.
And to
But
bring it back, to
it was
bring it back
interesting to
to
me
the
that the
first.
the AI that was discussed in the FDA town hall kind of stood out to me because it was interesting, but it also wasn't necessarily about drug development and AI. And right, I mean, a lot of what those folks were talking about was regulating AI products. Software, medical devices, other types of healthcare-related interventions. It wasn't so much about, so you want to develop a drug and use AI in the process of your clinical trial or drug development program, which is where a lot of the DIA kind of core crowd is coming from and sitting in. I think there's a lot of adjacency and a lot of shared learning there, but it is a bit different.
Well, and they talked a lot about how Elsa was created and the effort it took to validate her, and she's about to get an upgrade. So Elsa is the internal AI tool that FDA, and I think it's mostly in Cedar, but I could be incorrect, has developed to start help it with different tasks within the review or even information collation. So it's not to say that Elsa's making decisions. It's an efficiency tool within the organization, as I understand it, in its current form, right? But when you hear these experts who are deeply knowledgeable both about drug development and about what it takes to really build these tools in a way that feels repeatable and, I'll say, trustworthy. It was really fascinating. A little slice of insight to how thoughtful they were as Elsa was getting created.
We will see, right? I think there are a lot of folks that are
Yes.
curious about this with Elsa and where the intersections are. I talked to some folks, for instance, that are doing work with generative AI for with farm within pharma, right? That we're using Gen AI to create regulatory documents that are going to be parts of submissions. Those types of documents are going to land in that FDA knowledge repository, on which they're then trying to use generative AI to extract knowledge and insights. And so wouldn't it make sense to have kind of connectivity and shared learning between these platforms, right? It feels like in healthcare, we have some of us in healthcare that maybe are facing a denial of coverage, right? Where your providers are working a prior auth using generative AI, and the insurance companies are then using generative AI to deny those prior auths, right? Because there's an adversarial relationship. But we don't have an adversarial relationship when pharma is using Gen AI to create an IND or safety narratives or other parts of a submission. And then FDA wants to use generative AI to extract knowledge from those documents. And so, how can we maybe start to think a little more symbiotically across these different this current chasm, because that can help to create and inform the machines to make better quality submissions and help even enhance the content the FDA is receiving to make it fit and work even better in their environment.
Oh, I took a clear call to action to industry from Dr. Fakhouri. She said, "You guys need to share your operational data because we can't. We have it, but we can't share it because it's actually our job to protect it. But you guys will make more progress if you can find ways to put it together and learn from each other."
It's an interesting question, right? Because yes, pharma folks can share amongst themselves or in any way they want the data that they're submitting or have submitted in the past to the FDA. But here it's almost more the training and the experience of the AI machines the FDA is using rather than the raw content itself. You can keep that element of an IND submission confidential, but how did your machine make use of that content? Was it fit for purpose? Were there enhancements that, what's it called? Elise,
Elsa. She's
Elsa.
like from Frozen.
She's frozen. Is there content that Elsa would like to share, herself, based on her experience as a machine reading all of this? Here's what I would like you other machines that are feeding me content to do differently, rather than exposing anything about that content itself.
To give space to Jess, who I asked to share an insight, and she's able to do that now. So, Jess, please chime in.
Sure. This is my first time attending DIA, so I honestly had no idea what to expect. But I really enjoyed the whale tank. That was probably my favorite part. I just loved the way that they did it, and I thought it was very unique. And it really spoke to, that continuous improvement and innovation and everything in clinical research, right? But it was a different conference, just because, like I said, I had not been to DIA and I had not been to RAPS or anything either, so I wasn't really sure what to expect for the regulatory side of things. But the sessions were all great. I loved that they mostly did panels, so that way you weren't hearing from the same people the whole time. I no complaints here. Like I said, the whale tank though was amazing, and I really appreciate what they did for the Rift employees. I met so many incredible scientists at the event, and it was really amazing to just hear their stories and hear what they're looking for moving forward, and even that translational research side of things of, they were mostly bench researchers, and now learning more about even like clinical research and what that looks like after, it goes over into human subjects. And so it's been a really cool opportunity and made a lot of connections that I wouldn't have made otherwise. And yeah, so thanks for giving me the space to talk about it.
Hey Jess, a lot of the folks that are regular listeners here have met Joe and Ted and some other voices here
Oh,
before, but
yes.
could you take 30 seconds just to introduce who you are so folks know the perspective you're coming from?
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Greg. I'm Jess Thompson. I'm the founder and CEO of Clinical Research Pro. We are a community-driven training organization, and we're aiming to be a hub for clinical research professionals. So there's not really a good central resource for clinical research professionals to be able to understand what is actually in the industry, who's involved in the industry, sponsors, CROs, all that, but also the thought that not all of our clinical research professionals can actually go to conferences. So we're bringing the conference space to them as well to continue that education. So, yeah, so thank you so much for letting me talk about my passion in this industry.
Appreciate it, Jess. It also just helps us as folks are here in some of the spaces where you were most excited. I think the folks that tune in with us on the podcast probably over-index on whale tank fans. I would imagine that if you take the time to connect with this community, you probably the message and story of trial disruptors and innovators resonates with you. And so it was great to see that sort of come out at DIA. It'll be interesting to see how much that can kind of grow. A big reason why people go to events like BIO is because there's deal making space. A big reason why people have come to the DIA is because there's regulatory space. And so it'll be interesting to see if a space for entrepreneurs and innovators becomes another anchor point for the DIA annual meeting, so that it becomes, a reason for them to go and to see that corner start to grow. I guess
And
that's a job for you, Joe Dustin. Me, I'm just a humble fellow of DIA. That makes me like a gray-haired, like the judges in the Muppet Show, just kind of sitting up there, looking down, making snarky comments on
the judges or
podcasts
the
like this.
hecklers? I think you're the heckler.
Yeah,
You
something like
have
that.
the pin though, like the
That's
fight.
why it's kind of nice to have another lips that join the crew there at DA and have Rebecca have weigh in on and give some opinions on things. That was nice to see, Craig. That was
Ted
cool.
dropping the shout out to my daughter who was there at the DIA. She's doing an internship related to this field as a young student in health policy and communications. And it was fun walking the exhibit floor a bit with her. I would have thought she would have acted like the way I would have done as a young person in an exhibit hall with free crap is to grab a bag and to fill it up and just bring home a bag of crap. And, as a young person, she looked at it as a lot of waste that's going to land in wet in landfills. And why are they giving out all this stuff? Who's going to use any of it? And she gave a shout out to the folks at Medible. I posted that online. Jeff Parker, I think, is the marketing guy over there. But they had little notebooks that are compostable with sunflower seeds embedded in the notebook cover, so you can plant the notebook
Good.
cover when you're done, maybe grow a flower. I think, as one person noted online, I'd like to come back next year and see how many people actually grew a flower from it. It's a good sentiment. Maybe the landfills will have flowers growing in them. I'm not sure, but
That helps.
it's a nice picture, right, Ted?
It is.
I'll
I
end with
like
that.
it.
Yeah, I'll just say thanks for joining today and a call out to people to invest in things like DIA because that is where you build your team of people to help you when you're stuck. And that guy over there, Craig Lipsett, he's a guy I met at DIA. So that was a worthwhile investment that has been, let's say I've gone to the bank a few times with questions for him.
That was only like the DIA 27, 28 years ago. So that's all good.
Just yesterday.
Just
Yeah.
yesterday.
All right, guys. Next week we're taking a break because, there's fireworks and stuff happening. So we'll see you later.
Thanks, everyone. Stay safe,
Thank
stay well.
you. Bye.
Excellent as always.